His foot banged into a chair. The world flickered between normal and the land of Quicksilver. An old man stared straight at him, blinked, then tipped his mug and squinted at its contents. Min pulled Blaze outside. Even the air felt different, less cold than it ought to be, as if he had a blanket draped over his shoulders. Min seemed to glide down the street, dragging him behind. She ducked into a crooked alley. They'd no sooner gotten off the street than the boring old normal world hauled Blaze back into it. He turned in a circle. "What just happened?" Min popped into view. "Well, I'm no expert, but I'd say you just shadow-walked."
"But how? I didn't do anything."
"First things first. We were just betrayed, right? Was it by the servant or her friend who was supposed to meet us?"
"Doesn't matter," Blaze said. "Whoever it was alerted the authorities. They'll warn everyone in the Pillars what will happen to them if they're found sharing secrets. From here on out, no one's going to talk to us."
"So what do we do?"
"First, we get the hell off the streets."
He headed down the alley, keeping his eyes peeled for more of the king's men. They cut a wide circle around the ambushed inn, then walked quickly to their apartment. He couldn't be certain it was safe, but they hadn't revealed their address to anyone in Setevan, and unless someone had been following them, he would have noticed that, he liked to think, they ought to be able to sit tight and work things out. Upstairs, he locked the door and lit a single candle. "Before we try anything crazy at the Pillars, I'm going to pay a visit to my friend. She's well connected, might be able to put us back on course."
Min cocked her head.
"If you have this resource at hand, why did we spend all this time trying to scare up a servant?"
"I didn't want to get her involved.
Now, how did I do the thing I just did?"
"You must have been ready."
"Much like someday I'll roll out of bed and be ready to sing an aria. I'm getting the idea that no one bothers to learn the Nether because it's such a bunch of hooey."
"It's not like it came out of nowhere," Min said, an edge in her voice. "You've been training for months."
"Even so, it's like training to box, then discovering I've become an expert archer. These things are hard to explain because they're hard to understand. What happened in the inn was like betweening. It was life and death. Your mind was shocked back to the primal state when it's easiest to access."
He mulled this over.
"The first time Dante did anything was when we were in the middle of a fight.
So you've already witnessed such things happen."
"This is true."
"Okay, I don't understand it, but I believe it.
Guess the only thing that's left is to see whether I can do it again." He moved to the middle of the room and closed his eyes. The Nether flowed to him. Thoughtlessly, he let it go, then pursued its retraction into the non-spaces of its existence. He opened his eyes and looked on the dreamy world of charcoal and moonlight.
"That was easier than expected."
Min clapped.
"Oh, how many times I've wished I could make you disappear."
Blaze snorted. "So, should I be slashing myself up and things? I thought you could hardly make the Nether light a candle without dousing it in blood."
"It helps. You'll last longer and be able to do more with it."
"Are we still talking about the Nether?"
"The only way to learn what I mean is to try it for yourself."
"I will in time," he said. "But we've got a long day ahead of us tomorrow."
"Could be a long week.
Come to think of it, the only thing in our future that's apt to be brief is our lives."
He blew out the candle and went to the window to crack the shutters, as if the dingy alley might give him a look at what was coming down the road of his future. He was suddenly very tired. He thought about leaving that night, grabbing a berth on a barge to Yallan, and sailing into the open ocean, away from Gask and Malan, to anywhere. That was the point. You always had that choice.
It was a choice most people didn't take seriously. They understood that, theoretically speaking, other parts of the world existed, and that they could, in another universe, move to that place and begin a new life, away from their present troubles. Everyone got that.
But people thought about this the same way that they thought about a surprise inheritance from the wealthy bachelor uncle they never knew they had. Could it happen? Of course. Would it happen to them? No, no, of course not. The idea was a fantasy, nothing to be taken seriously, let alone to plan around. From a stoop in the alley, a man coughed. A grinding, deep-down bark that translated clearly to, "I will not live the winter." It was odd that he wouldn't consider helping the man. He might toss the vagabond a few coins, but he'd never take him in and nurse him back to health, nor find him a home and a job. Yet he couldn't stop himself from foiling Modigan's wrongdoing. He couldn't leave for a quiet homestead or a sunny island. That voice deep down inside him was telling him that his duty was here. More broadly, that he was and always would be the kind of person who needed that duty. Amid the bustle of daily life, that inner voice was often too soft to hear, but obeying its requests was the only way to be happy about who you were. It was time to stop fighting it, to get done what needed to be done, by whatever means necessary. At the moment, what most needed doing was sleep. He took care of that, then went round to the stables for the horses. Snug beneath their cloaks and hoods, he and Min rode into the countryside. A dirt path snaked through the hills. It took some doing to find the farmhouse, though that was the point. It stood alone in stubbly fields that wouldn't be ploughed under for weeks yet. Blaze rode up slowly, both to let himself be seen and to allow him space to bolt if someone else had gotten to Taya first. He stopped a bow shot from the house. After a couple minutes, she walked out onto the packed dirt outside the doorway. She was as ropey as ever, and a sword hung from her hand. She'd let her brown hair grow out, wearing it in a warrior's knot behind her head. Blaze lowered his hood and hopped from his horse. Taya didn't smile. "Who's she?" "Trustworthy." "Then tell me you met her prior to your recent leave." "Hey, now, the quality of the time is more important than the quantity, isn't it?" He smiled. "Anyway, without her, we're pretty much doomed." Taya looked straight at Min for the first time. "By what, exactly?" Min gave Blaze a look. "You're sure you can trust her with this?" "With zero doubt," he said. "Before the unpleasantness at the palace, she was helping me take down Modigan. You both trust me, right? Ergo, you can trust each other." "I make my own decisions," Taya said. "And that's why we love you." Blaze pinched the tip of his nose. "How about you listen to what I've got to say, then decide?" He laid out the events of the last few weeks, starting with their travels to Galador, abbreviating anything relating to Min's association with the people of the Pocket. It took a few minutes to get through. During, Taya didn't invite them inside. "You find this credible?" she said after. "Modigan does," Blaze said, "enough to risk stirring unrest in Galador. Within the Endless Pillars, even the servants know about it." "I wouldn't call that proof. Min knew about Selen before any of this, but not that it was on its way back. Don't ask how. All I can say is that her source is beyond reproach." Taya moved her fist to her chin. "I'm not used to taking so much on faith, even from you." "I'm from Pocket Cove," Min said. Taya's eyebrows did something they weren't inclined to do. They lifted. "Which your people never leave." It was time. "There's more to this, isn't there?" Taya waited for them to go on. After a long moment, she folded her arms. "I don't know anything about Selen or anyone in the Endless Pillars, but I know someone who might." Blaze grinned. "I knew it! Lady Caraday of Rollin." Oh, he said. You mean the same Lady Caridae of Rollin I tried to destroy?
She is furious that the king snatched up the bosson from her.
Isn't she equally furious with me for accepting the deal? Or how about the fact that the deal was intended to wipe the buyer out?
She's aware that when Modigan makes you an offer, you smile and shake hands.
Taya tipped her head forward. Blaze had learned this meant she thought he was missing something bleedingly obvious.
And the fact you are attempting to bring him down will only endear you to her.
Really? Because it sounds like she'd view me as a tool to beat him with, one she would gladly break in half over his head.
Then it's your job to avoid getting broken.
Blaze laughed. Just when I thought I'd missed you.
Taya smiled.
She made arrangements to contact Caridae and told Blaze how to find one of her agents in Setevan, a man he and the Lady of Rollin could use to ferry messages without exposing themselves.
That was the extent of her aid.
But it was more than Blaze had expected. After his disastrous departure, he wouldn't have been surprised if the only thing Taya felt like offering him was the business end of her sword. He and Min rode back to their apartment in Setevan to wait out the tedious process of exchanging covert messages with a person as busy and important as Caridae. Yet it only took 3 notes from both sides, and a day and a half of running the messenger ragged before Blaze and Caridae had arranged to meet. Apparently, she was eager to ruin someone. Either the king or Blaze. He wasn't too worried about himself, however. He'd been practicing his shadow walking, and confirmed he could do it at will. It turned out that Caridae had moved into Setevan for the winter, but she didn't want Blaze to be seen at her residence any more than he wanted to jump on his own testicles. The rendezvous was arranged to take place at Sorin, a half-ruined amphitheater set in a hill on the southeast side of town. In days of yore, the site had served as a slow-motion battlefield between citizens who used the grounds for extra gardens and the transients who used it as a home. Several years ago, Modigan had cleaned the place up to prepare it for restoration. The expense of the war had put a stop to that, yet the Redshirts still patrolled it often enough to ensure it remained abandoned. After a minor squabble, Min accompanied him through the city, then hid herself in the remains of a stone house on the edge of the meadow. Blaze crossed the dark field alone. His swords hung from his hips. A small cut dribbled blood on his right arm, waiting to feed the nether. Limestone arches ringed the theater. Some had crumbled, but most of the outer wall was intact, and he spotted 3 men lurking atop it, doing their best to conceal themselves behind the stonework. He passed beneath them. Semicircular terraces led to the sunken center that once served as the stage. Caridae waited there, amusement dancing in her eyes.
"Hello, Pendeles," she said. "How did you know I wouldn't kill you?"
"You can call me by my real name, which you know, and that's how you know we're on the same side and thus have no interest in killing me." He gazed up at the pale walls.
"Anyway, if you wanted to do away with me, you'd have invited me to your house. There's no reason to fear being seen with a traitor when you intend to hang him from your rooftop."
"Fair warning. I'd already thought of that, and assumed you would have too."
"Then I guess I'm just that eager to fuck over the king."
She chortled.
"Blaze Buckler. He'd pay a fortune for you. Maybe I should turn you in and retire somewhere sunny and carefree."
"I was having similar thoughts the other day," he said, "but I can't deny who I am."
"It's exhausting knowing yourself so well, isn't it?"
She shook her head, smiling wryly.
"In exchange for what I'm about to tell you, I'd settle for a slice of your luck.
Just tell me how to extract it."
"I have people at the pillars. Modigan runs it the same way he runs his stables. His beasts are taken care of, but the only time they're let out is to be fitted with saddles and reins."
Blaze clasped his hands.
Please tell me there's dissent within the ranks.
These are sorcerers. They command the powers of the gods. Do you think they like being treated like trick ponies?
Then why would they help me stop the king from grabbing Selen? Why not just use it to depose him? Or at least negotiate for more autonomy?
She waved one hand.
Think, Sir Bucklar.
He narrowed his eyes. Because the fellows at the top have no intention of rocking the boat. If they are made to fail in their task, however, Mordekaiser will treat them the way you treat any horse that's outlived its use. Feed them to the dogs.
I see you've got more on your side than dumb luck.
She sat on an eroded stone bench. One of those who wants change knows how to achieve it, but they can't be directly involved.
So you'll happily pass that danger to me. What do you want in return?
For you to get it done.
Blaze grinned crookedly. Deal. What do I have to do?
Steal a stone.
Goodness, I can see why you had to call on a man of my talents.
It's vital to the process of locating the object in question, she said.
Don't ask me how. I doubt my source knows.
It's guarded, isn't it? Locked up at the top of the pillars, behind a phalanx of the court's most terrible nethermancers.
Would that be a problem? Then be glad you're wrong. It hasn't yet been found. They're homing in on it in the Norrin territories right now.
The territories? Blaze glanced around and lowered his voice. Lady Caraday, you're positive of this.
You're friends with them, aren't you? Maybe you will have a chance after all.
Your target is a man named Kinnevan. If you don't recognize the name, be glad. Many consider him the most powerful member of the Endless Pillars.
What else?
He won't be alone. I don't think they're traveling at the head of a legion of men, however.
Mordigan's afraid of riling up the Norrin again.
She chuckled.
My source says they're scheduled to leave Dolendun this morning. The rest is up to you.
I might be able to pull this off. He extended his hand. If I do, you'll understand if I don't come running to tell you about it.
She shook his hand.
The anguished screams of the king will have to serve as my herald.
He jogged up the amphitheater steps. As he left the ruins, he thought he ought to feel some reverence for the landmark, but at that moment it was just a bunch of old rocks.
Interesting. Maybe, but he had a mission.
He collected Min from the ruined house and led the way back to the city.
Well, Min said, you look like you just fell in love.
After what she told me, maybe I have. Listen to this. We're about to desert enemy territory and head to my home turf. We're headed to the Norrin territories.
That's your home turf?
If you're 7 feet tall, you hide it well.
Shave 3 times a day, too.
He stumbled on a root and scowled over his shoulder.
I worked with the Norrin during the war. Unless I've been thrown out for non-attendance, I'm a member of one of their clans. We'll be hunting a group of sorcerers and...
Sorcerers?
I'll have the whole countryside to call upon for help finding them.
Blaze finished.
Hey, we know a few tricks ourselves.
We'll have surprise on our side, too. Not to mention my unfathomable brilliance.
She watched him from the corner of her eye.
You're in a good mood.
Glad to be getting out of here.
It was late. It felt like his entire life these days operated during the times a wise person was tucked beneath the covers, but he knew he wouldn't feel safe until they were outside Setevan. He jogged to the stables, glad he was back in a civilized place where a man could pick up his horse whenever he damned pleased, and paid his dues. They mounted up and struck southeast on the road to Dolendun.
Even been to the territories?
He asked, once they were beyond the city gates.
Never. My father made it clear they weren't the sort of place good people went.
Well, try not to be insulted.
By what?
Everything. They're different, especially the clans. She nodded, without much interest. He didn't bother pressing the point. As a child, she'd lived among the sheltered and wealthy. As an adult, she'd lived among the society of hermits that comprised Pocket Cove. To her, everyone was different. He rode the horses as hard as he dared. He still had plenty of Denny's money, and wasn't shy about spending it on lodging and care for their mounts. Wherever they stopped, he kept an ear open for gossip about Kinnevan and his group, but didn't pursue the matter hard enough to draw suspicion. He already knew the trail led to Dollondon. 2 days, and several hours after leaving Setevan, Dollondon blanketed the hills along the river. Blaze hurried through the human side and crossed the bridge to the east shore. Towering Norrand fished from the rocks. Others unloaded barges at the piers. Men stared openly, but had the sense not to ask questions. After a bit of hunting, Blaze found the unmarked pub. It was mid-morning, but the games of Nulladoon were already in full swing, and Ford was there to watch. Blaze moved beside him. Ford didn't look up. Blaze cleared his throat, then elbowed the man in the ribs. Ford turned on him with the momentum of a bull. To prevent the impending head-smashing coming his way, Blaze tugged his hood down and winked. The Norrin grinned. "Pend, shh," Blaze said. "Can we go somewhere private?"
"Do you ever not have secrets? Wouldn't you like to know?"
Ford smirked, detached himself from the Nulladoon table, and brought Blaze and Min into a back room that also had a game board. It was unoccupied, however. Nulladoon was a public event, and Blaze doubted whether this room was used for private games more than once a season.
"I'm sorry to impose on you," Blaze said once Ford had latched the door, "but I'm here to save the world. You know how it is."
"Sounds like my finder's fee is going to be enormous," Ford said. "I'm all ears."
"A few days ago, a human male named Kinnevan passed through here. He would have been with a small group, no more than a dozen."
"If he was human, I doubt he spent much time on the eastern bank."
"He might have. He was heading into the territories."
Ford rubbed his hand up and down his beard, ruffling it.
"I'll ask around."
"Great. Even better if you can find me someone who speaks to Joson Joe."
Blaze tapped his ear. "Follow?" The Norrin blinked.
"How do you know about that?"
"Through perfectly legitimate means. I'll tell you about it later, like at a moment when the fate of the land doesn't hang in the balance."
"I can find you someone who speaks to Joson Joe, but you ought to know better than to think they'll want to talk to you about it."
"Then it's time to put this cursed name of mine to good use. Tell them it's for Blaze Buckler of the Broken Herons."
Ford planted his palm on the wall and laughed for days.
"That's true. How were you ever allowed to join a clan?"
Again, a story for a non-disastrous time. Right now, every minute counts. Blaze let him know they'd be at the inn across the street under a fake name. In the common room, Ford cast a lingering glance at the Nulladoon tables, then hit the streets. Blaze and Min walked into the inn and rented a room on the ground floor.
"I didn't realize they'd be that tall," she said. "It's like being a child again."
"It's only frightening when they're mad at you."
He felt like he ought to be running down leads, but he didn't know as many people in Dollondon as he once had, and if Ford got results as quickly as he seemed to think he could, Blaze would be better served staying put where the man could find him. He seized the opportunity to get some of that sleep he kept hearing about, sprawling in the oversized Norrin bed, but was yanked from his nap less than an hour later by a knock on the door. Ford walked in with a woman just as tall as he was. The Norrin's scaled-up features made it tricky to gauge their exact age, but she was on the younger side. Seeing Blaze, she grinned, then forced herself to go sober.
"How do I know you're you?"
"If I were Morn of the Nine Pines," he said,
I might ask how you know you're you. Or you could loon Hop of the Broken Herons and ask him exactly how far I had to swim to join the tribe. Her grin retook its place. Pleased though she was to meet him, like most Norren, she wasn't one to take a person's word at face value, especially any word spoken by a human. Gazing steadily at Blaze, she sat on the bed and conducted a series of terse conversations through the bone earring in her left ear. In the end, she described him head to toe to whoever was on the other end of the loon. She closed the line and looked him in the eye. "You're you. Tell me what you need done." Several days ago, a human named Kinnevan entered the Norren territories via this city. He's traveling with a small group of men. They may be searching for a stone of some kind. I need them found.
Can you narrow down the area?
Nope. Fortunately, I've spent enough time with the clans to know they watch their lands the way a farmer watches after his daughter. She laughed.
I'll see what I can do.
She sat on the bed and muttered into her loon, repeating Blaze's description of the men 4 different times, presumably to 4 different clans, which was a good start. There were scores of clans, and historically, they'd been the definition of clannish, squabbling over territory, grievances, and differences of philosophy. But during the Chainbreaker's War, Blaze, Dante, Hop, and Morn had united them, providing them with loons they could use to keep in contact and coordinate their movements against the many tendrils of the king's invasion. Blaze didn't know exactly how well that network had held up in peacetime, but unless it had collapsed completely, word was about to spread far and wide.
"I've beseeched the gods for answers," the woman said. "Now let's see if they smile on our prayers."
The gods apparently had a light schedule that day because she was back on her loon within 10 minutes. Blaze listened close, but he couldn't hear the other side at all, and she didn't say much more than one-word acknowledgements.
"I've just heard from the Clan of the Splitting Sky," she said. "Their territory begins not 50 miles from here, and they saw a group that matches your description. Just yesterday."
Chapter 29 Dante stood straight up.
"Arrested? Knack? What are you talking about?"
"Sombor says," Knack explained patiently, "that Lou has been taken prisoner by Spirish soldiers. Sombor says he's on his way back to your Lauren now. I hope any of that makes more sense to you than it does to me."
Dante thanked him and signed off. Ast was looking at him expectantly. C jogged in from the flat, drawn by Dante's raised voice.
"Lou's been taken," he said. "I don't know how or why. Sombor will be here in a minute."
There was nothing to do but stand on the branches and wait. The thin man ran in through the woods a few minutes later, still disguised as a desert shepherd. Dante climbed down the roots of the Lauren to meet him.
"Let me save you from asking questions I can't answer," Sombor said. "I was on the 3rd loft, conversing. I heard a disturbance on the 4th loft. I saw Lou shouting. I went up to see. They'd blocked the stairs, but from my position, I watched the minister's soldiers haul Lou up into the higher lofts."
"Did you see where he was taken?" Dante said.
"I was unable to bypass the blockade."
He spoke in the flat tone of someone used to delivering objective and detailed reports.
"When it became clear I could learn nothing more, I returned to relay what I'd seen and discuss our options."
"What options? We find out where they're keeping him and we bust him out."
"Confirming to the minister that we're here. Now that he's got Lou, he's too smart not to have guessed that on his own."
Sombra's brows tightened. "Successfully freeing Lou will only expose our strength. The minister will be forewarned and on watch for us, greatly reducing our ability to achieve our primary objective."
"I've been eavesdropping on him," Dante said. "I heard him talking about using a raft of corpses to sicken Ellen. I don't think he's the type to make sure his prisoners are getting 3 meals a day, especially if he's figured out we're from Narashtovik."
If he wants us, the logical course is to use Lu as bait. He may hold a public trial, or declare Lu's amnesty in exchange for us revealing ourselves.
He'd never hold to that. He'll execute us the second we turn ourselves in.
Did I suggest otherwise? Somber said. What I'm suggesting is that we have time. Time to finish the maps, to see whether there's anything more we can learn about Selen. Once we're finished, if you're certain it's the right course, we can rescue Lu from whatever stupidity got him captured.
It doesn't matter what he did. We're not leaving him behind.
Dante closed his eyes and pinched his temples.
I'll get back to the maps.
Can you figure out where he's being held?
If they have a prison, it should be simple to locate.
Dante didn't like his use of the word if. As Somber headed back to the city, Dante returned to the squirrel hidden in the map room. He resumed copying, working as fast as he could while staying focused and maintaining his precision. The maps covered a broad swath of land. Skewing one line in the wrong direction could send them miles off course.
Somber says Lu is being held in the keep, Knack informed him through the loon.
A couple hours had gone by, and the yellowing light of afternoon was giving up its fight to penetrate the canopy.
He's trying to learn more, but he doubts that will be possible.
Dante estimated he had no more than an hour left before he finished the last section of the map, but he couldn't wait another second. He tucked the squirrel away inside a desk, then shifted his vision to a second squirrel he had waiting in the canopy above the palace compound. Squirrels were easily the superior choice for navigating the tree city, but they were a little on the large side and tended to draw attention when indoors. Anticipating the need for a higher degree of stealth, Dante had equipped this one with a passenger, a dead mouse clinging tight to its back, tiny claws digging into the unfeeling skin of the larger animal. He navigated the squirrel through a series of ever-thinning branches until it dangled from the leaves 10 feet above the roof of the keep. This was square, shielded by corrugated walls pierced by numerous arrow slits, and empty of everything except a thick layer of leaves. The squirrel let go. Being entirely dead, it fell without so much as a squeak. It landed on the sludgy leaves, bouncing once. Dimly, Dante sensed that it appeared to have cracked a leg, but since pain meant nothing to it, that would do little to hamper it. A closet-sized stone shack stood in the middle of the roof. A grilled door blocked the entry. The mouse skittered through the bars and down a cramped staircase into a long hallway. Many of the doors were closed. People talked in soft voices behind them. Entirely the wrong feeling for a prison. He sent the mouse further downstairs. Two servants walked down the hall, arguing viciously about whose turn it was to hang the wash lines. Dante tucked the mouse into a doorway and waited for them to pass. Once it was back on the run, there ensued many minutes of scrambling about and hiding whenever anyone came near. The mouse's search wasn't entirely at random, but Dante had no idea of the keep's layout or where the cells might be, and seeing everything from an inch and a half off the ground did odd things to your sense of direction and scale. As the mouse ran past the doorway, Dante caught a whiff of filth, the co-mingled miasma of sweat, feces, urine, and sickness that could only be generated by people in captivity. The door was closed, but air flowed through a warp in the jamb. The gap was just large enough for the mouse to squeeze past. It crawled out onto an alcove, overlooking empty space. At the edge, a ladder stretched from floor to ceiling. Dante moved the mouse to the edge of the platform. The stink came and went. Somewhere below the mouse, a moan carried on the wind. The mouse crawled past the platform's lip, clinging tight to the wood. It was currently on the ground floor, but the platform hung below it, a couple of notches carved into its surface. Overhead, the ladder led to nothing,
it was currently raised. Time for a leap of faith. The mouse dangled from its claws, then dropped. Dante's view tumbled, and he had to pull back into himself or risk vomiting. When he returned to the mouse, it was standing on the platform, gazing dumbly down a walkway fronting a row of cells. These shared walls, but the fronts and backs were enclosed by pitted iron bars, leaving the cells open to the elements. The mouse padded forward. This dungeon had been attached to the underside of the massive flat supporting the keep, where the prisoners couldn't offend the residents, nor, if they somehow escaped, could they go anywhere besides 400 feet straight down. Nearly all the cells were bare. Three were occupied by mounds of blankets. Dante located his target by smell, it being the one of the three mounds not decomposing. The mouse ran between the bars of the cell, infiltrated the blankets, looked on Lou's face, then tickled his nose with its whiskers. Lou slapped at his face, snorting. His eyes went wide.
Gah!
He bolted to his feet, throwing the blankets and the mouse away from him. He pressed himself against the bars, arms spread wide, hunting frantically for any sign of the vermin. Dante now had to figure out how to communicate to Lou that this was his mouse before Lou stomped it flat or booted it off the platform. The mouse hopped from the blankets, stood on its hind legs, and waved. Lou's jaw dropped. He laughed, outstretched arms falling to his sides.
Is that you?
Dante made the mouse nod.
If you could, I bet you'd be yelling at me right now, wouldn't you?
The mouse nodded harder.
Well, you shouldn't.
Lou folded his arms. Unless it's with words of praise. Because I know how we're going to find Selen. Back in the round, miles away, Dante squeaked in surprise. On the platform beneath the palace, the mouse went stiff and straight, the model of attention.
I went to the Spire of the Earths, Lou said. Well, I didn't. I sent a dead squirrel just like you. At first I couldn't find a way in, but then I saw rat droppings around the back and found their hole inside.
Had to fight some of them.
Have you ever had to fight as one of these animals? It's crazy.
He looked around the windblown cell as if remembering where he was and what he was saying.
Inside it's like a library for rocks. There's basalt, sandstone, travertine, pumice, marble, everything. It's incredible. When I was a kid, I used to be fascinated by rocks, all these little bits that make up the world. Anyway, they're laid out on these wooden benches, and there's a platform you can walk around to look at them. They've got just about every mineral you can think of. Later, I went to see Jotun. He told me the spire is there to help the Spirish remember the ground they left behind. It's a religious thing. We didn't really get into it, because the squirrel saw something I couldn't understand. On the top floor, it was all marble samples. One piece was black, but it was spangled with silver dots and stripes, kind of like when you're looking up at the night, and you whip your head to the side, and the stars turn into streaks. I had never seen anything like it, and I thought it was pretty, so I got the squirrel to hop up next to it for a closer look. As soon as I came near, the rock gave off this greenish glow. It was very faint, and I thought it might be a trick of the light or something wrong with the squirrel, so I backed it off, then moved in again, and the glow came back again.
Lou pressed his face to the bars and glanced down the platform. Satisfied they were still alone, he sat before the mouse.
I didn't know what the stone was, but Jotun did. He said it was described in a long-lost account as the platform on which Selen last manifested. It glows in the presence of Nether, and they've got a piece of it. Do you know what this means?
Dante made the mouse nod. His entire skin had begun to tingle.
That's when they caught me, Lou said. But I was heading back from Jotun's. Since then, I've had some time to think.
You're going to rescue me, right? Well, you can't. Not until you get the stone. Don't try to argue with me. They'll put me on trial before meting out any punishments. Just be quick and I'll be fine.
He smiled down at the mouse. Dante wanted to say he was sorry for not letting Lou be more involved, and to promise they would get him out, but the mouse was a mouse. And it was dead. And he had no way to communicate any of this. He made it bow, which made Lou grin, then moved it to the corner where Lou could speak to him again, should anything more come to mind. He loomed Knack to tell Somber to come back to the Lauren. While he waited, he maneuvered a squirrel through the branches to the tower at the end of the flat and located a rat hole in its base. Tufted fur and dried blood littered the dark passage. Inside, thin windows cast wan sunlight onto cuts of stone, just as Lou had described. At the top of the tower, he found the silver vein stone and moved the squirrel close. A green nimbus appeared around the rock. Something jabbed his mind, calling for attention. It was the mouse. Lou was speaking to someone. Dante put the squirrel on hold and shifted to the other beast. Inside the cell, the minister gazed down on Lou, hands clasped behind his back.
"To find them," he was saying. "You can be the person who helped us, or the person who worked against us. In which situation do you think you'd be better off?"
Lou was huddled on the floor, back touching the bars.
"I told you, it's just me. My friends were killed by highwaymen."
"Very plausible. The world's a dangerous place. You never know when all your friends will be killed by bandits. But if that were true, why would you flee to a place that had promised you death?"
"So I could cross the Wodens, get home."
"By yourself."
The minister pressed his fingertips to the bridge of his nose, squeezed his eyes shut, and laughed in disbelief.
"Either you are very stupid, or you think I am. Then what brought you back to Carl?"
"They took our money," Lou said. "I barely had any food. I knew I could find Lorebells here."
"Right. Throughout the entire forest. In fact, they are easier to find out in the wilds than they are here in the capital."
He raised his brows. Lou's mouth quivered.
"I thought I could find a guide to get me through the mountains."
The minister sighed, lowered himself to a crouch, and crawled forward on his hands and knees until his face was inches from Lou's.
"I don't like liars creeping around my home. I'm going to put out my hand. In it is your only chance to save yourself. Will you take it?"
Never taking his eyes from Lou's, the minister extended his hand. Lou shook his head, a single jerk of his chin.
"I can't give you what you want."
"You speak remarkable third for a Gascon. Has one word you and your people told me been true?"
The man stood, gazing past Lou and into the open air beyond the bars.
"Make your peace."
He stepped out and locked the grilled door. A man and a woman waited on the platform, observing. Dante could tell at a glance they were Nethermancers. They followed the minister down the boardwalk.
"Should I have tried to kill him?"
Lou whispered once they were gone. The mouse shook its head. Somber appeared across the woods. He was still negotiating his way up the tree's roots when Dante's attention was jiggered again. This time it was the squirrel. Footsteps echoed up the hollow chamber of the Spire of the Earths. He moved the squirrel behind a jagged hunk of red rock. The footsteps reached the upper level and continued across the planks. The minister lurched into view,
He gazed down on the black and silver stone for a full minute, then turned and walked back down the stairs. Dante related what Lou had discovered to the others.
This is the last piece of the puzzle.
At the very least, we can find Selen by using the glow of the stone. But I expect I can follow the nether inside it directly to the platform where Selen was last used, and where it will return.
According to a single, long-lost apocryphal account, Somba said.
I just watched the minister walk into the tower and confirm the rock hadn't been disturbed. Anyway, you're the one who tipped Lou off to the Spire of the Earths?
That's because I'd already learned the minister spends so much time there.
It is incredible what a soldier will tell you when you're wearing a woman's body.
Somba got an odd look on his face, chuckling. Ingenious hiding spot.
Mixed in with a bunch of other rocks in a temple no one cares to visit.
Here's the plan. We have to steal the rock, but if the minister knows it's missing, he'll kill Lou on the spot. I'm going to see if I can make one that looks like it and swap them. If not, I'll carve a piece from inside it and take that. Then we go get Lou.
He's a nethermancer, isn't he?
C said.
Why doesn't he just bust himself out?
I'm not sure he's got the juice, Dante said. Even if he did, they've got the prison isolated beneath a flat. He's got nowhere to go.
Somba laced his fingers together. There are no branches above the spire. The only way to get to it is by passing through the palace grounds. I bet you are wishing you knew someone who could make you resemble one of the minister's soldiers.
Dante laughed.
Would be even better if you could make us invisible.
Impossible. But I will make us look like soldiers, on the condition that we bring the stone back here before we go for Lou.
Are you trying to give me an order?
I'm making it clear that I will not participate in any plan that exposes Narashtavik to unnecessary risk. It would be within Dante's authority to insist Somba do as he was told, but he didn't think a battle of wills would help them toward their goal.
Dante had some ability with illusions, but nothing like Somba. He couldn't pass himself off as a soldier. Anyway, deep down he didn't disagree with the man. Lou and the stone might be on the same loft, but if they went for Lou while the stone was in their possession, they could lose both.
They would secure the stone first. In addition, that meant Somba wouldn't be able to accompany him to retrieve Lou. If something were to happen to Dante, he'd need Somba to escape with the stone and put it to use.
To minimize the chance of discovery, they'd pose as citizens until they neared the palace loft. This would mean paying the tolls for multiple lofts, but during his time in the city, Somba had scrounged up some of the teeth they used as currency. Dante wasn't inclined to ask how. Once they neared the palace, they'd find a quiet place to switch their appearance to soldiers, then enter the palace grounds, wander in the direction of the spire, wait until they were alone, and break inside. The spire was padlocked and bolted, but that was no barrier to them. Once they were inside, Dante could have the stone, or a piece of it, in moments. Then all they had to do was walk down from the tree and deliver it to their Lauren. After that, Dante would be on his own. C volunteered to assist, but he turned her down. Through some combo of stealth and force, he would get Lou back. Cover of darkness would help. If he had to, he'd use a blade of nether to sever the head of every guard in his path, sending them tumbling into the night. He never got the chance. As afternoon faded to evening, a disturbance on the prison flat returned his attention to the mouse. In Lou's cell, an unnecessary number of soldiers were lifting him to his feet, checking him for weapons they had obviously already relieved him of.
They're moving him, Dante said. Don't know why.
This isn't good, C said.
Somba pushed his knuckles against his mouth. Our priority is the stone.
Dante twisted to look at him. I know that,
do you? You could go up there, disguised, then do what? It'll take me 10 minutes to reach the tree, 20 to climb to their loft. If something happens, how do you get to the spire without me? Prayer?
Dante bit down on his lips so hard he tasted blood. He knew better than to argue. His resistance was token, an appeal to the conscience that was irrelevant. He was putting on a show for Aston C., more likely for himself. His knowledge of this only made him feel all the more helpless. As the soldiers departed the cell, Dante directed the mouse to leap onto Lou's boot and climb up his pant leg. Lou shivered but didn't make a sound. They marched him down the walkway and up the ladder, which had been extended down to the cells. Once they had extended the alcove to the keep, a soldier hauled the ladder back up with a clang, particles of rust drifting down.
"Are we going to see the minister?" Lou said.
It sounded like a fishing expedition, more for Dante's benefit than for his own information, but the soldier said nothing. The troops took him down the spiral staircase, wrapped around the Lorenz trunk. After descending one loft, they turned off onto a flat groaning with people. Torches flapped from its sides. The crowds watched the procession with wary hunger. Near the end of the flat's usable surface, before it forked into a dozen round branches hardly thick enough for a man's feet to rest on, the minister stood alone, hands open from his sides.
"Our nameless, homeless guest," he said.
The soldiers brought Lou to the edge of the crowd and shoved him forward. Lou stumbled, catching himself 10 feet from the minister, who closed on him one step at a time.
"Ready for your trial."
A mile away, Dante glanced across the round. "They're putting him on trial.
Lyle's balls! We've got 1/6 of the Council of Narashtovic right here! We have to do something!"
"In what way does this change the logic we built our plans on?" Samba said.
On the wide, flat branch high in the sky, Lou forced himself to straighten. Dante dropped the mouse to the top of Lou's foot, but everyone was oblivious, watching the faces of the two men.
"I haven't done anything to anyone," Lou said.
The minister pushed out his chin, nodding in agreement.
"Who said you had? Last time I saw you, I ordered you never to return. It doesn't matter if you think you've harmed anyone. You're a foreigner, a liar, a malcontent. Do you declare me unsound to issue orders?"
"Of course not. The heavens saw fit to grant you the responsibility of this land. I could never question their judgment."
Torches flapped in the evening breeze, drawing a shine from the minister's eyes.
"Then you agree my pronouncement was just?"
Lou lowered his head.
"I do, but I hope my circumstances are worthy of exception."
"So, justice is justice only when it's bent?"
The minister glanced across his people, who remained silent.
"You are exiled on penalty of death. A little bit of bad luck, and that excuses you to return to the one place you were banished from. You are accused of trespassing in Spiron. And here you are."
He grinned and patted Lou's shoulder. Lou smiled, hesitant. The minister jerked him forward and ran pell-mell toward the edge of the flat.
"No!"
Dante screamed. Lou grabbed at the minister's clothes, but the silky black fabric eluded him. The minister heaved him off the branch and dropped to his knees, skidding on the smooth surface. Lou's voice pitched up in panic, fading as he fell, still clinging to his shoe. The mouse looked up into a tangle of branches, a horde of faces fading in the distance, eyes white in the light of their fires.
"Don't let him do it!"
Lou shrieked, and then the wind of his fall tore the breath from his lungs. Dante stood, lurching toward the entrance of the round. C grabbed his cloak. He might have turned on her, but he was lost in the vision of the branches whipping past the mouse's sight, tearing at Lou's clothes. Then came a thud so loud Dante felt it in his bones. The mouse's vision tumbled, tail over ears, and went dark.
He's...
Dante moved to the side of the branch and clapped his hand to his mouth, the back of his tongue stung with the taste of vomit.
I suppose you'll want to kill him.
Sombra's voice sounded 1,000 miles behind him, as if it were fighting through an endless sea. Dante couldn't keep the quaver from his voice.
How did you guess?
Do you want to cut out his heart?
Then take from him what's dearest.
Somehow, this hammered the hot fragments in Dante's chest into a single blade. He wanted nothing more than to storm up the spiral steps of the minister's lorren and cleave everything and everyone in half until the ground was thigh-deep in bleeding bodies. He thought he could. The soldiers would be nothing to him. The minister and his house wizards, but they were amateurs, charlatans. Dante could tear them apart like slices of bread dropped in a lake. But this was a fantasy, an indulgence of his ego. His path led to the stone, and then to Selen. There could be no detours. Dante climbed down to the ground and found a boulder. A sloped hunk of limestone furred with round nodes of springy green moss. He reached into the nether, and a bowl-shaped hunk of rock became an agile fluid. He could make it shift and flow as he pleased, but no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't force it to take the sparkled hue of the stone of the Spire of the Earths. Not wishing to exhaust himself, he gave up and returned to the round. As darkness fell, he finished copying the last of the maps. Ast sat before them, arms planted to either side, as if he needed to brace himself for whatever he was going to see within the pages. They spoke very little. The hoots of owls hung in the air. Around 10 that night, Sombra stood and Dante joined him. The man muttered to himself, shadows whipping around his hands. In a blink, Dante's clothes took on the look of spirish garb, the baggy leggings and sleeves. The baggy leggings and sleeves. The tan on the backs of his hands paled by 3 shades. Sombra had been replaced by a stranger, a man whose blank features could find no purchase in Dante's memory. They got down and walked through the forest. Lanterns twinkled from the lorens. Laughter hung in the air. The snap of cooking. He smelled the caramelized citrus tang of frying laurels. At the base of the lorren's main trunk, the roots reached down like the fingers of an enormous hand, trapping the lanterns of the residents like fireflies too weak to fly away. They reached the central tree and walked up the staircase. Wood smoke hung in the air, hazing the leaves. The ground fell away, but the babble from the roots followed them. Traffic on the stairs was light. The few people they passed glanced at their faces, registering them, then dropped their gazes to the next steps, politely ignoring them. At the first of the toll bridges, Sombra passed a handful of teeth to the watchman. He waited in silence as the stairs creaked down and landed across the gap with a dull thud. 5 lofts up, Sombra began to glance around. He stepped off the stairs onto a quiet flat that was free from structures, left open as a public park or farm. They moved behind a wall of leaves. Sombra mumbled again, and their clothes became the green uniform of the minister's men. They returned to the stairs. At the 3-part bridge beneath the palace loft, a soldier eyed them up and down.
"How's it been?" he said. Sombra shrugged. "Quiet." "Beats the alternative."
The trooper watched them, as if trying to decide whether to ask why they needed to go upstairs, then gave a little sigh and moved to the drawbridge mechanism. Hanging lanterns washed the grounds in light. The flat that has the spire